This is Fully Vested, a weekly podcast where Jason Rowley and Graham Peck discuss technology and venture capital investing. This week, we discuss the ongoing situation related to COVID-19, especially as it relates to layoffs at Lyft, Uber, and Airbnb, including Uber's contemplated acquisition of Lime and Grubhub, and Airbnb hosts exploring options to book guests through other means. The show was recorded on May 13th. You can learn more at fullyvested.co.
Graham.
Jason, how the heck are you?
Staying alive. How about yourself?
Oh, there you go. Good throwback to, the 80s music or whatever.
I think it was late 70s.
Okay. We'll go with that.
The BG, real-time Googling ensues. hang on one sec.
I'm in trivia mode. I've stopped instantly Googling something when I have a question because I've been playing 1 to 2 times a week. I've been playing virtual trivia where you're obviously on a computer, but not just Googling the answers. But I'm good.
Staying
Jason.
Staying alive. Recorded in 1977. Released. Ooh. On December 13th, 1977.
All right.
Staying alive. Graham, we have a very topic-filled show, as always. We are going to be checking in on the state of the sharing economy, such as it is, by taking a look at a couple of public companies in the ride-hailing space, namely Uber and Lyft, and then also taking a little bit of a look at the still private market with Airbnb. And spoiler alert. Yeah, sorry, Graham, not to talk over you, but spoiler alert. Things have been better. For all of the above.
Yeah, obviously it's no surprise that in the midst of a global pandemic that stops essentially all travel, it's not surprising that hospitality and ride-hailing businesses aren't doing well, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that the way that this is going to work is we should approach all this stuff thematically. First and foremost, we're going to be discussing, these companies in the ride-hailing sector. We're going to chat about some of the, let's see, what's the euphemistic way to refer to this? Their cost-saving measures that they've recently instituted.
Ouch.
Yeah. And then also discussing the sort of like changing business landscape that a lot of these, that those companies are facing. And I guess we should start off with Uber and Lyft.
Yeah, so it seems like the general tenor is that at least in so far as the like kind of ride hailing type of business, obviously that's the main or almost only line of business for Lyft, whereas Uber also has food delivery and some other kind of business segments, which we'll get to. But it seems that the ride hailing stuff is down pretty substantially. The numbers seem to be looking like down like 70-80% pretty much across the board. Yeah. In terms of customer demand for actual ride hailing. And, to just kind of hit the nail on the head, that has caused both Uber and Lyft to lay off the vast majority or a large percentage of their team, not the vast majority, but a large percentage. In the case of Uber, that's about 14%? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, 3,700 employees. Although there was indication that, at least based on reporting from the information, that Uber had been in internal discussions about laying off as much as 20% of its workforce. You guys can do the math. They've already laid off 14%. There's talks to possibly lay off 20%. Definitely means that more layoffs could be in the works.
And then at Lyft, it's kind of in the midst of that range at about 17%, so just under 1,000 employees. And obviously, you know, one of the other things that is not great is obviously the way that all of these folks found out about these layoffs was also via email.
Well, Uber, minor correction there. Uber let its employees know with no notice that they were being laid off via a 3-minute, to my knowledge, it actually doesn't matter if it's pre-recorded or recorded live. It was a 3-minute Zoom call that was given with no notice to all the affected employees.
Yeah, I guess what I meant was remotely. I'm sure, you know, I'm fortunate enough, including the current circumstances, to have never been laid off. But I've got to imagine that that's not a good message to either deliver or receive in any format. But obviously with global pandemic, they receive that remotely in some way, shape or form, be that email, Zoom or otherwise. It would also seem like it would be terrible to be kind of like one of the people who was getting laid off, especially if it was in a venue where other people who weren't being laid off maybe were receiving that message at the same time. Again, maybe there's no good way to receive that type of bad news. I got to imagine if you worked at one of these companies, you wouldn't be surprised that this was inevitably coming.
No, I mean, because again, like there's been lots of these are sufficiently big companies that there's plenty of surface area for leaks, and there's been chat, at least in terms of whatever the media has reported for, you know, a couple months now, that companies like Uber and Lyft are, you know, encountering some serious headwinds considering the collapse of their primary lines of business. Layoffs are going to be coming down the pipeline, but I guess it was just a matter of timing and magnitude. And, you know, the thing that sort of like strikes me about all this stuff, more than just the sheer numbers, it's also the composition of the teams that were let go. And at least when it comes to Uber, I can't speak to specifics about Lyft just because I haven't, you know, read all those details. But when it comes to Uber, you know, a non-trivial sum of those employees that they laid off were their engineers. And Graham, you and I probably know as well as anybody that engineering talent is some of the most expensive to acquire and some of the most expensive to retain. So, you know, going forward, having laid off all these people, Uber at least is potentially hamstrung, even when the economy and by proxy, the company itself sort of, comes out of its current status, you know?
Yeah. You know, and I think that is an interesting point. Uber's current layoff did or didn't include any engineering talent. I didn't think that it did. I thought it was mostly customer support, and then some of the like sites, like maybe references about 180, although I don't know how many there are, but sites where drivers can get local support. I thought that there had been a prior engineering talent cut. I didn't think any engineers were known to have been part of this layoff, although I certainly could be wrong. Your point is definitely true that engineering talent coming at such a premium, it's interesting to see anyone laying off those types of folks. And obviously there are tons of companies that unfortunately cuts have had to run that deep. I just didn't think Uber in this case specifically fit that bill.
So Uber, at least again, according to reporting from the information from late April 2020, Uber's engineering group could be cut by approximately 800 people.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, like I said, the company's already laid off 14% of its headcount, and they've previously discussed the possibility of laying off a total of 20%. At least from what I've heard from folks with knowledge of what's going on at Uber, I'm inclined to believe that there may be additional engineering cuts coming down the line, or at least that's what a lot of folks on the engineering team there are still worried about.
Yeah, you know, and we didn't introduce ourselves today's podcast, and we could interrupt right now and do that. But
you,
sure. So I'm Graham. I am a venture partner with Cultivation Capital, which is a Midwest-based seed and Series A stage fund group that invests in ag tech, life sciences, and specifically the team I'm on is our technology investing team. In addition to that work as a venture partner, I also work on the technology staffing front, often working with startups, although also working with some larger clients and technology development services companies on their staffing of developers, primarily providing remote development assistance through a company called Brightgrove, which has offices in Ukraine and Belarus. Jason, who the heck are you?
I ask myself that every day. Hey, everybody. My name is Jason Rowley, and I am a researcher with a company called Golden, which is seeking to build the canonical resource for knowledge. And when I'm not doing that, I do some volunteer work with the Python Software Foundation, helping them reach out to early stage startups, both here in the US and abroad. And in normal times, giving those startups space at PyCon US for free with no strings attached. So, yeah. Graham, sorry.
And so where I was going with that was, you know, in a lot of my work, what I'm doing is helping companies build high functioning, you know, development teams. And there is, for all intents and purposes, negative technology developer unemployment worldwide. So again, to see any company, but in particular, some of these really big companies getting rid of their engineering talent that they've paid exorbitant or at least very high salaries, bonuses, kind of total compensation packages for years, and not saying undeserved in any stretch of the imagination, but high compensation packages obviously indicates that, you know, that the situation is at least quite serious, if not dire for them. Obviously, anyone who's not living under a rock right now or in one of the few countries that have somehow remained relatively unscathed from this thing, which I would guess most of them are just under testing. But anyway, then obviously, you know that this situation is very serious at a minimum for basically everyone worldwide.
Indeed. So, yeah, no, I mean, like it's one of those sort of situations where, you know, one wonders, like, you know, of all the different types of things that these company or all the different types of employees that these companies could have laid off, you know, is laying off the number of engineers that they did a prudent strategic decision going forward? I understand that it's an incredibly effective way of cutting burn in the meantime, but, like, you know, you're letting go your brain trust, you know, that actually helps make the valuable thing that investors, customers, and everybody else alike decides to put some serious financial value on.
Yeah, and like in a lot of businesses, but certainly true in technology development, there's a lot of like, it's a really expensive thing, more from a standpoint of time, but to get folks up to speed, to get developers familiar with your code base and other kind of associated technologies, tools, and kind of communication schemas, that's really what's complex about, you know, about building a high functioning development organization. And so these people are knowingly walking away from teams that for the most part are already functioning with large scale mass adopted products that are already in millions or more of folks' hands. So
yeah,
definitely an expensive decision. Although I'm confident that, again, somebody was sitting there, you know, looking at a cost benefit analysis and probably didn't make those decisions lightly. I think in both cases, it's also public that that Lyft and Uber executives are also foregoing part or all of their pay, depending on position and kind of level, right?
Yeah, based on what I've read, I think that is true. And, you know, I'm sure that's very, it's very nice of them, I guess. but, you know, like even the highest paid executives at those companies, you know, there's the sum total of their salaries is probably much, much, much less than, you know, the amount of pay, like the payroll that the companies are no longer needing to pay from the fact that they laid off all, you know, a decent chunk of their engineering talent.
Right. I wonder if either Uber or Lyft were companies that had applied originally for payroll protection program loans. I haven't seen any information about whether either of them did and or considered returning the money. Not to give away too much OPSEC here, but as we record, and you will have already heard this in the intro, but it's May 13th, and the deadline to return PPP loans, if you choose to, you know, without any question of whether or not the loan was made in good faith, I believe is tomorrow. Although actually just today, which seems to be awfully short timing before the deadline of tomorrow, and I know of companies that have already returned PPP money that if the guidance that came out today had already been released, maybe they would not have. But in any case, I think the SBA today indicated that assuming you repay your PPP loan, if it is not determined to be forgivable for any one of a bunch of reasons, the list of which seems to be still increasing. But in any case, as long as you do repay it, they will not seek anything like sending executives of those companies to jail or things of that nature. So that was interesting guidance to get from the SBA one day before the kind of forgiveness deadline. They also said that any loan under $2 million is just automatically determined to be issued in good faith because of the size of the companies that requested those relatively small loans. Anyway, don't mean to get off of news in the ride-hailing industry, but it would be interesting to know if Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, WeWork, any of our kind of main topics constant whipping boys had applied for PPP loans as well.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the way that the PPP program has been administered, at least through the time of recording, you know, there's been a lot of ambiguity about, you know, who exactly has received, first off, who applied for funding, who's received it. I know that, you know, at least as of time of recording, there's a lawsuit that's been filed with the SBA, the Small Business Administration, by ProPublica, the Washington Post. I think maybe the New York Times. There was a few news organizations, and either AP or Reuters. I forget which one. Anyways, a bunch of news organizations have filed a lawsuit against the SBA to have that granular application data disclosed, but you know it really remains to be seen whether, whether or not that information is ultimately disclosed, and then you know based on the granular data that hopefully at some point will come out, you know we'll be able to figure out whether or not, whether or not any of these companies had either applied for or received or gave back what those, gave back funding from the PPP program. So, yeah, who knows?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to follow up on that in the future. So, anything else that's relevant in terms of the layoffs at Uber and Lyft?
Yeah, well, I mean, this sort of like is a bit of a tidy transition to, you know, a a discussion of, you know, the sort of underlying changes in the underlying business or market that these companies are playing in. You know, Uber recently led a funding round raised by Lime, and we can talk about that in a hot second. But, you know, while Uber was leading this round in this scooter and bike company, you know, it also laid off, at least to my understanding, 100% of the Jump Bikes and scooter division staff that were previously employed by Uber. And, you know, that to me is it's an interesting move, because on the one hand, like they're clearly making a decision today to lay off, you know, all these folks. But simultaneously, you know, it's by making this investment in Lime and some of the deal terms that they had negotiated effectively gives Uber a kind of like an options contract, so to speak, on not just, you know, acquiring the assets of Lime, but also to acquire the employee base of Lime at some point in the future if it becomes an advantageous move for Uber to do so. So, you know, I found that to be kind of interesting as well. It's like, you know, on the one hand, acting in a very short-term way, but on the other hand, setting themselves up for longer-term exposure to entering this line of business, e.g. micro-mobility, once again.
Do you think that entering the micro-mobility space is anything to do with kind of a less traveling future? I assume a deal like this and this deal specifically are probably been in the works since long before, you know, COVID-19 specific responses, but
I don't think that the Lime deal, you know, was, just came up. I don't think that the Lime deal was like in the works for a particularly long time. I think that, you know, probably the company, e.g. Lime, you know, made a more hasty run to, you know, to private investment markets than they may have otherwise done had this outbreak not happened in the first place. But yeah, I mean, I at least as far as the Uber Lime thing goes, I think that happened relatively quickly in terms of turnaround.
And do you think that Uber is making moves that are the beginning of trying to be opportunistic in terms of other companies that are potentially either benefiting from or being specifically kind of injured by the current circumstances, but trying to take advantage of maybe lower multiple expectations and harder increased complexity of completing funding rounds moving forward?
I mean, that's kind of that's a hard, I mean, on the one hand, you know, I don't have a lot of visibility into what their long-term or short-term strategy is in terms of their corporate investing. But, you know, it is notable that at least in the past couple of weeks, it looks like the company has committed, you know, many hundreds of millions of dollars in terms of cash and equity to exploring some of these deals. So yeah, it seems like at least at the moment, Uber is finding itself in this position of like needing to leverage the assets that it does have to explore new business channels going forward. Because again, it like we previously discussed, their the ride hailing side of their business has just sort of evaporated, you know, to the tune of about 70% to 80% in these COVID times, you know?
Yeah, and I realize that the way I asked that was kind of a what does your crystal ball say today kind of question.
Like, I
you know, I
one.
just Yeah. If anybody does have a crystal ball, then please reach out to Jason or me after this episode, because I'd love to, take a gander and see what the crystal ball says about the future. But all of that being said, I guess my personal belief, and this doesn't represent either Jason's belief necessarily or any of my partners at Cultivation or anything, but I think there will be a lot of opportunities that come out of this. And unfortunately, I think some of those opportunities will come from negative circumstances, either companies that had over-levered themselves and or kind of baked in too much growth projection, into their future. And I think there will be a lot of companies that, that take advantage of that coming out of this. I didn't know if it was becoming abundantly clear, maybe that Uber was doing that in that kind of acquisition option almost of Lime, Uber's also in discussions of acquisition of Grubhub as well. So,
yeah, and that to me seems like a really interesting move on their part. I mean, I have sincere doubts as to whether or not that deal is ultimately going to end up going through. If not, because of, decisions on Grubhub's end, for example, then perhaps due to regulators who are interested in the potential antitrust risks of allowing such a deal to go through.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about antitrust, in the technology space, which, if we rewind a long, long way back to the 90s and we hosted a similar podcast, which of course podcast didn't exist, we'd probably talk a lot about antitrust and things like, Microsoft and others. And while I'm certain that antitrust cases have continued to happen, they haven't kind of been front and center. But it would be interesting to see if regulators would allow one publicly traded company, Uber, if this acquisition were successful, to have something like 55% of the food delivery, the aggregated food delivery market, if you include their market share and Grubhub's.
Yeah, I mean, and it's the share of the total market, but it's also the ability for, if this deal were to go through, it would be for Uber to be a even more active price setter for, the actual service component of food delivery, right? Like, they'll be able to they already have like one of the largest networks of drivers who are doing food delivery stuff. But, this would give them even greater pricing power over, over what those drivers are paid, because there wouldn't necessarily, it's removing one other competitor. Like nothing had previously prevented a Grubhub or a DoorDash or something like that from paying more than Uber did. But now that there's one fewer competitor in the market, if this deal were to go through, which again remains a really big if, that strikes me as a pretty significant consolidation of power, that redounds to Uber's favor, if this deal were allowed to go through.
Yeah, I think that'll be an interesting one to watch. What do you think will be the, you seem to be skeptical about it, that deal, that potential deal's future, and other than regulator complexity, what are some of the reasons that you think it's likely not to occur?
So first off, like Donald Trump is president and nothing really matters anymore, and like so much of our economy is already in not so great a state, so I'm part of me is inclined to say that the regulatory side is slightly less likely to matter now, but that's just me being cynical. I think that the other thing to keep in mind is that, and the regulatory side is real. Like, there is a compelling argument for regulators to not allow this deal to go through, or if they did allow it to go through, to impose a number of different terms and conditions, you know, to allow it to happen. You know, I was reading the daily update from Stratechery, one of the past ones, recording today. And, you know, Ben Thompson raised the possibility of, you know, a regulator saying, well, yeah, Uber, you can acquire Grubhub, but you'll also have to divest, you know, yourself of Grubhub's business in New York City or San Francisco or Chicago or whatever. And if that sort, if those sorts of stipulations were put forward, it's Ben Thompson's contention, and I would imagine both of ours as well, that that sort of removes the incentive that Uber has to make that deal happen. Because like what, like, because
yeah, that
their
that
biggest
makes
markets
a lot of
are
sense.
Big cities, and like what are you going to do? Like, you're going to, you know, sell off the assets of, you know, your five or six major core markets, and then just have like Grubhub's, what, their like marketplace for food delivery in the suburbs and like very small cities? No, like that size of that market isn't, you know, it doesn't really make sense. And I think maybe the other thing is, to my knowledge, there hasn't really been any publicly disclosed information around pricing of this deal. No, actually, wait, that's not true. There was some information around the pricing of the deal, but like, it's important to note that because this transaction is going to be happening all in stock rather than cash, at least according to the terms that were initially discussed in news reports, that if there's any material fluctuations in the price of Uber shares over time, that could make the, you know, that deal more expensive or less appealing, whichever way you want to view it, from either Uber's or Grubhub's perspective going forward. Granted, you know, it's not like Uber has a bunch of extra cash lying around. You know, it's far too busy hurling, you know, massive piles of money onto the fire. You know, at least for now, their equity is worth something, and can be used as currency in a transaction such as this.
And you mean that even pre-COVID, even pre-ride-hailing business dropping between 70% and 80%?
Oh yeah, no. I mean, Uber's been a financial
just buying growth.
Oh yeah,
and we've talked about that some before, whether on this podcast or personally and directly. Some of the biggest employers of the capital as a moat strategy, which I think we covered in one of our early 2020 episodes as one of the trends from last decade that wasn't likely to survive much longer. Although, yeah, I continue to think watch trend interesting. And I think that trend is even less likely to have any success, of course.
Yeah. No, I mean, so like what just sort of like boggles my mind is that like so many people are stuck at home now, and like in at least in theory, you know, the market for food delivery has gone up pretty significantly. And like at the same time, all these like food delivery companies are not they're not able to turn a profit, you know, even now when in theory demand is higher than ever. And, you know,
have you seen any data about how much higher demand is? But like how many people are just sitting on their couch getting lunch or in particular dinner delivered to them, like as compared to pre-COVID?
I haven't seen any concrete numbers around that. Unfortunately, I'm sure that that's information that will end up coming out in earnings calls and other types of press releases, probably, you know, come Q2 earnings season. But at least as of right now, I haven't seen any, you know, very concrete numbers around that. Based anecdotally,
that'd be interesting to know.
Oh, for sure. Anecdotally, though, I have heard that that order volume is up. But, you know, the other thing to just note, especially in the case of an organization like Uber, you know, Uber Eats remains largely a bit of a rounding error in their, you know, in their income statement. So even if, and this is not what I've heard, this is not the case, but like even if Uber Eats has doubled its order volume, which again is not the case to my understanding, it would still probably not be enough to make to have a material effect on the company's overall financial performance, you know, at least for the time being. Now, granted, a lot of that could change if the deal with Grubhub does end up going through, which would vastly expand Uber's market and order volume. But yeah, no, I haven't heard any concrete numbers, you know, that have been publicly reported yet. Just hearsay from friends in the business.
It'll definitely be interesting to see if Uber is able to, you know, kind of successfully pull off either of these, you know, acquisition and kind of deal structures, or decides to pull the trigger on Lime and or is able to end up getting to a place where terms are reached with Grubhub.
Yeah. I mean, and again, like who knows? Literally anything can happen at this point.
You know, one of the other things that's maybe interesting to talk about before we move to a different segment of the, of the gig economy being Airbnb, is at least Lyft, but maybe others have also raised capital in kind of these times. And there's kind of some interesting things going on. Lyft in particular, I think, raised $650 million in a convertible debt offering, which will convert in something like 5 years to either a return of that cash or common shares or some combination of those two at Lyft's discretion. So it's interesting to see companies, publicly traded companies taking advantage of, you know, credit markets at this point in time. Although obviously, obviously they're going to need a lot more money, and they're doing a lot of things, including the layoffs we just talked about and other, to make sure they have the requisite runway to get, you know, to kind of get where they're going. But is there anything, you know, what are the things that you think are of most note in terms of their debt raise recently?
So this is one of those things that is where there's still a lot of stuff that remains to be seen. Lyft did end up, you know, putting this through on May 12th. So as we record, this happened yesterday. And at least at this time, information about the interest rate, the conversion rate, you know, will end up being determined, you know, if and when the offering goes through. So the only thing I would just highlight is that at least as of right now, it's very difficult. It's unknown just how expensive this capital is going to end up being for Lyft once this offering ends up going through. So yeah, there's still a lot of ambiguity there.
And because the conversion's not determined for another 5 years, give or take, it could be unpriced in its long-term cost for quite a long time.
Yeah, I mean, but the coupon will be decided when the offering goes through. It's just a question of, you know, what the conversion dynamics are.
Sure, of course.
But yeah, I mean, like that's the thing that will be very interesting to watch from, really from any perspective. But, you know, if you're an investor, it might end up proving profitable for you. Chances are their interest rate is going to be much higher than the basically 0% that you could get if you're investing in treasuries. So, you know, but it's also the case that at the end of the day, Lyft could end up paying quite a lot out for receiving, you know, the $650 million.
You know, and as of the time of recording, not to make this too time sensitive of content, but you know, Lyft stock is down about 35% in the last quarter. Uber's is down about 23%, and the S&P 500 as a whole is down 13%. You know, at least the S&P, that's coming off of all-time highs. Uber and Lyft, that's probably not true.
No, they're still there,
since both of them have struggled since their IPOs, essentially, which obviously we've talked about before.
Yeah, Uber and Lyft alike are both trading well below their IPO prices. So,
yikes.
Yeah, yikes indeed. Yikes indeed.
So if there's any silver lining in that, do you think these potential, you know, acquisitions, jumping kind of back just a little bit, you think the potential of Uber exploring acquisitions is something that'll make up for any of that? That being its public kind of failings?
Maybe.
Stock price?
Well, I mean, to that end, you know, I've heard it characterized from you know, from folks who might be in a position to know that a lot of Uber's that Uber's current moves around acquisition offerings or investments with the possibility of an acquisition in the future, such as in the case of Lime, I've heard those transactions characterized as a fairly masterful bit of financial engineering. So like, yeah, maybe it does end up being the case that, at least from a numbers standpoint, you know, it looks like Uber, you know, comes out of all these moves, you know, sort of on top. But I just don't, I mean, to me, at this point, it seems like throwing, you know, bad money after good companies, or good money after bad companies. But there's money being thrown at places, and I don't know if the outcome is going to be good.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we're way too early. I hope and think that as we get further into this, those kind of unknown unknowns will become more known. But I feel like even as this thing, it's what feels like long in the tooth to me personally, I think we're still a long way from knowing anything like that, unfortunately, because so much is changing so rapidly, you know, every day.
Oh, yeah.
One of the articles, and I assume that they'll keep updating this because I think it's a kind of standard table, but one of the articles that that we read in preparing for this episode, which we'll link in the show notes, you know, indicated that the U.S. had nearly 21,500 new cases today, and that was the most new cases still. So, in theory, probably every day is a new high.
Yeah, at least in terms of caseload. Yeah, I mean, it's not great. I mean, like I saw a headline earlier today, you know, Texas for the last 5 days has seen 1,000 new cases of COVID each day for 5 days, you know, shortly after the state, quote unquote, began reopening its economy. And yeah, it none of this seemed good. I on the one hand feel I want to have some sympathy for, you know, where the folks at Uber and Lyft, and we'll talk about Airbnb in a second, are. But on the other hand, you know, it seems like there's enough that there's so many different balls in the air that like all these companies would wish for nothing else than to like have the equivalent of like a pause button. You know, to just be like,
obviously,
just be like, oh man, we're going into corporate hibernation for you know, a couple of months and just waiting to see how all this stuff shakes out. But obviously that's not possible. But I can guarantee that a lot of folks, especially at Uber and Lyft, would love that to be the case.
You know, to go off on a little bit of a rant, you know, for a moment, I made a personal deal with myself back in high school when I don't remember what was happening, but something that I was particularly not looking forward to, like a doctor's visit or a test or something like that. And I said, boy, I just can't wait to get through this thing that was some period of time, a couple of days away, I think. And a friend of mine said, you know, Graham, I really wish you wouldn't wish your life away. And so I kind of promised myself right then, because I realized even then, and I certainly think that time is the most valuable asset that any of us have now, much more than I did when I was, you know, between 15 and 18 or whatever. But I tried to make a pact with myself right then that I wouldn't wish any of my life away. But I certainly wouldn't mind if we just fast forwarded to when all of this is done. I am generally an optimistic kind of person. And I feel like we don't have a lot of good news to share. I'm trying to take a upbeat look at things, and there's still, you know, there's still not a lot of good news out there. I guess, you know, maybe go watch John Krasinski's Some Good News, which is great if you haven't. But boy, I don't know. I'm ready to get back to covering on this podcast exciting new funding rounds and other things like that, even though maybe we've, you know, had whipping boys in the past.
We can always revisit our favorite whipping boys. Like they're not, at least for right now, they're not going away, and they're continuing with their historical patterns of, let's just say, interesting corporate behavior and financial decision making. So
I was going to go with shenanigans, but you said it better.
Sure. Well, what I mean to say, Graham, is that we will have plenty of fodder for the long haul, you know, throughout as the pandemic as it exists today continues to unfold over the next several months. So
maybe switching topics a little bit, you know, one of the other businesses that we're going to talk about that obviously is having some struggles, you know, is Airbnb. From article that we use as part of our job, it was really interesting because the video during that, someone did make mention of, well, like Uber and WeWork, which are shells of their, you know, former selves. Anyway, the rest of the video was about Airbnb hosts and how they've been struggling with some of Airbnb's policies about refunds and other things like that during these interesting times. So, but again, just to get one more lash on WeWork there, continues to be interesting, of course. And obviously we weren't fans. I was a fan of working in a WeWork, but we weren't always fans of all of the things that they did to this. I think they're going to have a lot of challenges moving forward. But
yeah.
Anyway, Airbnb. Yeah. I would, you know, yeah. I've thought for a long time about being an Airbnb host, and let's just say I'm glad I'm not one.
Yeah, there's, I mean, where do we want to start with Airbnb? Like, you know, the company laid off 1,900 people, some 25% of its workforce in early May. You know, the company now. To its credit, this is something that I thought was neat. You know, Airbnb, despite laying off, you know, many, many hundreds of people, they did end up creating a a list of all the folks, or at least many of the folks that they had laid off, to basically create a list for recruiters to help folks get jobs at their next thing after Airbnb. And I thought that was a very nice bit of good corporate citizenship on their part.
That's really cool. I think it's certainly cool that they're doing that. One of the other things that we'll include is kind of a tracker of layoffs from funded tech companies that are still hiring. And so I think that all of these companies, especially as they get rid of engineering or other kinds of talent, doing whatever they can to help those people make as gentle as possible a landing in the future certainly is a great thing. And I think even the CEO of Airbnb maybe tweeted out a link.
Yeah, Brian Chesky.
To that job portal.
Yep. Yeah. No, he did. And again, I think, Airbnb is it's clearly a company in a serious bind, just because, obviously they're in the travel space and everybody's stuck at home. Nobody's traveling. And so they're in a position where they have to, on the one hand, rapidly adapt, but there's a significant limit to the ability that a company can adapt if they're also facing like close to zero demand for the things that they were previously offering as products or services.
And Airbnb was already interesting in that it was a unicorn in terms of its valuation, right? I mean, I think the high watermark, that was pegged was a slightly over $30 billion valuation with their last equity capital raise in 2017. And they were also profitable. So they had
they were profitable for at least one quarter. They sunk back into unprofitability after that. One quarter, two quarters, but yeah, like the company was doing reasonably well, and they had stated, at least in the toward the end of 2019, they stated publicly it was this amazing like one sentence or two sentence press release, where to paraphrasing, they were just like, Airbnb intends to go public in 2020. This does not constitute a solicitation to sell securities, yada yada, whatever all the legalese was. But for all intents and purposes, this COVID is a true black swan event for a company like Airbnb, which again was doing quite well, and did have a relatively clear path to public markets this year, and as I'm sure anybody is able to surmise, whether or not they're an avid follower of, the venture investment space or Airbnb in particular, obviously Airbnb's plans to go public in 2020 are on hold, to say the least. And to that end, I can discuss, a stopgap measure that Airbnb had implemented to continue funding its business going forward. The company did end up raising $1 billion in a combination of debt and equity from investors Silver Lake and Sixth Street Partners, and that deal was announced on April 6th. I don't have the number in front of me, but it was my understanding that at least the interest rate on the debt component was rather high. I don't have it in front of me. I don't have any information about what the valuation that was arrived at for this deal, in terms of that equity component. But I'd venture a guess, no pun intended, that at the very least it's optimistically it's flat, but probably down somewhat from the. From its last private market valuation from before the time of COVID.
Man.
Which really sucks for Airbnb, because Airbnb was like, you know, they have, there's all sorts of like other stuff happening behind, you know, behind the scenes of that company. Like, I don't have serious, I don't have any details besides like what I've read in the news, but like they had these, their, you know, their employee, equity packages, would sort of like blow up, if the company didn't get some sort of liquidity event, in 2020. You know, it seems like, there's significant pressure for the company to get some sort of liquidity event under its belt, whether that's a public offering or I guess at this point probably a tender offer, or a secondary market offering for Airbnb's shares, you know, to give their employees an opportunity to liquidate.
And up, meaning that a lot of folks who had, you know, had options that were options or warrants that were potentially worth a lot will end up expiring worthless. By the time those expire, which is ostensibly this year, right?
That's my understanding. Yeah, in broad strokes, that's my understanding.
And is it? Am I right to get in one more lash on our whipping boy that WeWork has a similar structure in place with some of its employees? Although maybe 2020 is not the expiration date of those.
And
we weren't prepared to discuss that.
Yeah, sorry, man. You're kind of putting me on the spot regarding WeWork. I don't have as encyclopedic a knowledge of their financial situation as I perhaps otherwise either should have or would perhaps more accurately enjoy having. Mostly just for the sake of my own sense of Schadenfreude.
Got it. You know, one of the things that I think was interesting that was brought up by the article that, you know, that we read in prep was that many people are going out and creating their own either independent or joining much smaller kind of aggregators of their vacation listing sites. I guess I would have a bunch of questions about that. Some of which is, are you realistically able to get anyone to rent short or long term your place today with travel being down so much? I mean, I'm someone who is used to being on the road, you know, sometimes as much as 50 to 75% of the time. And I haven't, you know, left my small hometown in over 2 months. But I mean, I guess, again, that would be one of my first questions is, does that work? And is anybody traveling and doing, you know, short-term rentals at this point in time? Above and beyond that, I would want to know if they've changed their cleaning procedures. And then, you know, kind of from the business standpoint and from what the CNBC article talks about, I guess my other question would be, if you're a small business and you've got a relatively small number of properties listed on an independent website, are you able to actually get the traffic you need, you know, driven to that? And are you able to do that in a way that's cost and time effective enough to make it worth not paying Airbnb what could be as low as 3%, but what often ends up being a little bit higher? Sorry, that's kind of a whole series of me thinking out loud, but you know, I kind of wonder how this is going to end up working out for these Airbnb hosts who are already in big trouble, and they may be, far be it from me to tell anybody not to kind of strike out on their own, but at the same time, I wonder if they're just kind of pouring salt in the wound of their, you know, kind of current struggles.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, like, the stuff that I... So, first off, like, I think that those are all really good questions. Unfortunately, I don't have answers to many of them. And I think that very few people do, at least as of
probably
right now.
Even the people. Yeah, probably even the people who are trying these things aren't sure yet. I mean, the article makes reference to a handful of specific Airbnb hosts, and the ones who launched their own independent websites only got those going over the last 3 to 4 weeks in most cases.
Yeah, I mean, but like going forward, it's really important to note that this is a I wouldn't necessarily call it an existential threat to Airbnb, because it's not like there's a it's not like there's been like a massive exodus, you know, from their platform, right? I mean, see this, it's not like we've heard, oh, 50% of hosts have left Airbnb, right? That's not the case.
Right.
But, you know, back to you know, the subject that you know, I know that you and I previously discussed on this podcast, you know, a company like Airbnb, its value is sort of predicated on having a large-ish inventory of proprietary to have like a large-ish proprietary inventory, right? E.g., hosts that are only hosting their properties on Airbnb and nowhere else. And so over time, if this becomes more of a trend where, you know, home sharing hosts or short-term rental hosts or whatever sort of term you want to use, if more and more of those folks end up leaving the Airbnb platform, it reduces the moat that Airbnb has been able to leverage, which is its very large base of rental listings, short-term rental listings. So,
yeah. And did they have any requirements of exclusivity on their platform?
In certain cases, they do. So, so I've not necessarily combed through all of Airbnb's terms and conditions and business practices and policies and whatever. But like, you know, you might remember that they had, for example, you know, Airbnb had invested in that company Atlas Obscura that.
We had talked about that in great detail on a prior episode, and that was what was part of powering some of their new experiences that were available through the platform.
Right. And there was an exclusivity deal around, you know, Atlas Obscura's content, you know, or experiences rather, being listed on Airbnb's platform. And so I can infer, although I do not know this for 100% sure, that Airbnb, that there is an exclusivity component to at least some of Airbnb's listings, particularly around I forget the name of their like high end, short-term rental product. It's like Airbnb, like Select or Lux or something like that. But I'm going to make the assumption that there's an exclusivity deal around that. And there may be, you know, other types of exclusivity covenants placed on other types of listings on their platform. But as I'm sure that both of you, you know, we both know, and I'm sure most of our listeners already know, it's common for hosts to, barring, you know, any sort of exclusivity clause, to list their listings on a number of different services.
Yeah, and you know, and obviously I think that's probably, you know, somewhat detrimental to the Airbnbs of the world, but obviously that's, I think, kind of the way that it goes. Again, I think it'll be interesting to see how the experiences of staying in a short-term rental go, but also how, you know, how these folks who do strike out independently, go in the future. And I kind of disagree with one of your earlier points. It's you're actually right, of course, that there's not an existential threat in that, like, you were not seeing mass exodus of people from Airbnb. But I think there is an existential threat, of course, to everything in travel holistically right now. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how many people, the CNBC article points out, you know, folks who have 250 plus Airbnb properties, and that's what their whole business is. It'll be interesting to see how those folks, you know, fare, you know, coming through this experience. So again, there's a huge threat to travel holistically, obviously. And that's affecting way, way more than just Airbnb. But, you know, I mean, I think we're going to see airlines file for bankruptcy. I wouldn't be at all surprised if we see hotels that struggle, you know, even really big brands, as well as mom and pops across the board.
Yeah, I mean, for me, and this is just sort of like me perhaps being, you know, transparent to a fault. If Airbnb ends up stumbling, I personally am not going to be that upset. On the one hand, you know, I've enjoyed using their service, and I've stayed at a lot of Airbnbs in the past. But it also does have some, you know, deleterious effects on the housing markets in the cities in which it operates. So if short-term, you know, landlords end up needing to liquidate their properties onto the open market to be used as housing for regular people rather than tourists, I think that could also end up being a possible net good that comes out of this, even though that would come at Airbnb's expense.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair point.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I was hoping to be more optimistic when we started talking about Airbnb, even though I know that there were layoffs and other things there.
No.
So, you know, I was hoping we could like finish on a high note, but you know, it's just not the way things are going right now.
Graham, there is no high note. It's
for our listeners out there, Jason and I have a kind of parking lot of future topics. And during this episode, I made the note in our parking lot that we should have a episode that's about good news going on during the coronavirus crisis. And I know even in the startup space that there is that. I've certainly heard of companies that are benefiting from increased demand and things like that. I mean, even outside of the obvious like Zoom and others, there are a lot of companies that are finding these times to be beneficial for a variety of reasons. So maybe we'll have a good news during COVID times episode in the near future.
It'll be a very short show.
Oh, preview of coming attractions.
Indeed. Graham, you want to wrap it up?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, man.
Stay safe, everybody.
All right. Chat with you next week.